Hi, it's your host, Terry McDougall. And today I've got Rob Jollis. He's an author of a number of books on business and sales. And after a long and successful career in sales, he's now a presentation and sales trainer. Part of the reason why I wanted to have Rob on today is to bring the sales perspective to this marketing conversation. Because in my career as a marketer, cultivating a close relationship with my partners in sales was often critical to the success of our marketing initiatives. Yet, it's an area that can often be fraught with friction and conflict. Rob is going to bring great insights and tips to this episode, which will hopefully support your success. However, if you're running into obstacles building those relationships that are critical to your team's marketing success, a certified executive and leadership coach like myself can often help. Please reach out to me for a free consultation by contacting me at terrybmcdougall.com or check the show notes for more information. I'd be happy to talk with you to see if we might be able to work together to get past these obstacles that you might be facing. So without further ado, let the mambo begin. Welcome to Marketing Mambo with your host, Terry McDougall. It's the fun and fast podcast where we cha-cha chat with marketing movers and shakers from around the globe. Hey, everybody, it's Terry with Marketing Mambo, and I am so excited today to have a special guest, Rob Jollis, founder and CEO of Jollis & Associates. Rob is really a pioneer in customer-centered selling and influence training. He's the author of several books on influencing others, including How to Change Minds, Why People Don't Believe You, and Customer-Centered Selling. Rob, welcome to Marketing Mambo.
Oh, great to be here. I'm ready for those questions.
Great. Let's kick it off. So, Rob, give us a little background about who you are and where you came from. How did you get started in sales?
I came out of the University of Maryland thinking, okay, world, it's time to fight over me, and quickly realized they weren't fighting over me. So I took a job at the New York Life Insurance Company. I sold life insurance 2 years, 4 months, 3 days, about an hour and a half. I did very well monetarily. I had no problem generating income. As a matter of fact, my first year I was number 11 out of 7,800 agents. I was challenged with the why behind it a little bit. I was 21 going on 22, selling a bunch of 22-year-olds life insurance. So I want to be real clear. I do believe in life insurance, obviously. Not so sure every 22-year-old on the planet needs it right now. But New York Life taught me to love selling. I went to work for Xerox after that. Xerox taught me how to sell. So between the love of it and the process behind it, I think that really helped. 27 years ago, I left Xerox, became a professional speaker, 2.5 million miles in the air, and not so much lately, but I go around the world and I love working with groups and talking about selling.
First of all, I forgot that we're both fellow Terps. My other comment is that you must have been pretty good at selling if you were selling 22-year-olds life insurance.
Oh, yes, I was. I had a process. I used to call it insuring insurability many years ago. But I still remember that there was an obscure policy purchase option. It was a dividend option that would allow you to double your insurance without evidence of insurability. To this day, I think if you're going to buy it as a single 22-year-old with no home, no family, no children, just protecting your right to get it in the future is actually worthwhile. I did believe in that part of it, but it was still a little dicey for me.
Okay. So clearly you understood how to influence. I can't imagine that the premiums were that high either on 22-year-olds.
No, they weren't that high. I remember they taught me to love selling. The only way I learned how to sell it at New York Life was I had memorized what they called the live, die, quit story. I memorized what they called the 100-man story, which had a wonderful mantra at the end, which was, Terry, these people, they didn't plan to fail. They failed to plan. very emotional, and you drove them to what happened to 100 people by that time. In any case, I was also a struggling actor. I liked the acting element, believe it or not, of the scripts that I was learning. But we all know, and don't worry, I've moved off the scripts many years ago, but that was my lifeline. That's all I knew. There was no real sales process there. It was just learn these scripts, 2 a week, 10 a month, and don't let us catch you in the bullpen. That was my sales process.
Yeah. And by the way, here's the white pages. Just start dialing.
Yeah. I actually came out of the gate like a rocket ship. I was nicknamed by New York Life because I was putting up the good numbers. They called me the Rocket when I was 21. And that was on my door. I really bought into it. I did coincidentally have 36 first cousins who lived in the state of Maryland, 6 other uncles, 2 other aunts, and that was just on my dad's side. So yes, an insurance agent was born. My second year, I finished with the family and was able to make the top club there. I fooled everybody and I got through my second year, but then I just woke up my third year and I went, I don't know if this is really what I want to do, but I love selling. Where else can it take me? And away we went.
Yeah. Actually, I was just on a networking event at my undergrad, William & Mary. They had something for the alumni and I volunteered to mentor. And there were so many kids that were like 22, 23 years old that are trying to figure out like, what do I really want to do? It's just a tough time when you first get out. Sometimes you just got to get out there and see, what do I not like doing? Part of the reason why I wanted to have you on today, Marketing Mambo is about cha-cha chatting with marketing movers and shakers from around the world. And you and I met a little while ago when I was on your podcast, and we just really hit it off. And I have always enjoyed working with sales whenever I was a marketing director. I really like that partnership. For every relationship that's super positive and synergistic between sales and marketing, a lot of times there are relationships that can be filled with a little tension or static. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on why it's important for marketing and sales to work together and what people on either side of that relationship can do to ensure a more productive relationship.
Yeah, for some reason, isn't it funny? They keep us on two sides of the river there. It reminds me when you were asking that question, I was thinking when I sold for Xerox, how in a sense, it was the same between service and sales. It was like, stay away from those guys. You don't want to mess with them. And there was a fence in between until you realize as a salesperson that one of the most valuable people, and I'm speaking at Xerox now, is that salesperson who has a different ear of the client and is hearing different information. My goodness, that should be my best friend. But getting to your question of sales and marketing, oh my goodness, if it's done right, and obviously I'm a sales guy, so I'm more onto the sales side of this, but I've worked with major Fortune 500 companies and had to literally beg them to let the marketing people come through the sales training. And they weren't that happy either. Their arms were crossed and folded for the first hour. But the fact is that when, and you tell me if this is interesting as a marketing person, when you really look at the science behind selling and you figure out not just sales tactics, but why people make decisions, processes they follow, where their decision points are, even the most basic point of sales, how we psychologically look at the problem and not the need and study the problem, because that's where 80% of anyone can connect to. From a marketing angle, why would you want to show the need, the solution then on a website or a brochure that about 7% of the population can identify with and say, oh boy, I need that. Whereas 80% of the world says, I don't need that, turn the page. We show them the problem, not the need. I'm giving you one example, and there are many, of an area where, wow, not only should we be getting along, but here's something that we can help you with from the sales side. I'm quite sure there's many things from the marketing side you could teach us. There should be no fence and there should be no river. We should be on the same side.
I agree 100%. I was actually a buyer for a long time early in my career. I was in the print production area. And so I was buying millions of dollars worth of printing. So you can imagine that the salespeople really liked me a lot. There wasn't a place in Washington that I didn't eat out on some printer's dime. But I learned a lot being across the table that way. And then when I moved into being a marketing manager and I was working with salespeople with the company, because I had been exposed to so many salespeople, I knew I don't know. I've always liked salespeople too. I like the goal orientation, right? They're going to wind them up and they're going to go. I like that. And I really appreciate that. I think that what marketing can bring to the table is maybe, okay, stand back and evaluate the situation a little bit, look ahead and say, what are some of the trends and so forth. But I think sometimes when we're reading the research or whatever, we might be making assumptions about this is what our customers want. And the people that really know or the people that are out talking to them every day, I'm talking about myself as a marketer, can come together with the salespeople and we can bring the longer term theoretical, like kind of brand positioning perspective to the table with somebody that's, okay, I just was with our biggest client yesterday and this is what they told me. We can come up with better solutions that are going to serve us for a longer period of time. Some of the static or tension between sales and marketing can be that marketing is a little longer term focused about, okay, we're building a brand for the life of the company. And salespeople are focused on what did they sell this quarter. That's how they get compensated.
Let me jump in on that.
Except for my sales brothers and sisters. Yes, that's the stereotype. But anybody who's out there selling will readily tell you that if all we're looking for is that transaction and to get our bonus and win our trip, and believe me, there's tons of that out there, we're not going to be in that position very long.
Right.
Our job is to open up a long-term relationship, cross-sell while we're with the client, move from being a vendor to a trusted business advisor. Mm-hmm. So in fact, you'll find the top ones, and isn't it funny, those stereotypes on both sides, but the top salespeople would absolutely agree. And you hit on something really interesting. When you start talking about branding, for example, do you know how many salespeople are actually confused? Not their fault. A lot of times the product managers don't really know. They're just there to regurgitate product. But what we often don't know about a product is, well, what is the thing? If a client walked in and wanted nothing else and it was the best thing about this product, what would that be? Because it seems to do a lot of things. Take a car, whatever you want.
Yeah.
There's a lot of features, a lot going on. What is this, the specific of that? Volvo got it right years ago. Mm-hmm. What do you think of safety? All cars are safe, but by sticking to a brand message, Volvo sort of cornered the market there. Be it right or wrong, that's our perception. For salespeople to not be communicating with marketing and understand the branding and understand those pieces rather than be learning a series of features and benefits. Now I'm going to sell features and benefits. That's old school. That's exactly why we need to be having that conversation between sales and marketing. It's critical.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think of it as this Venn diagram of, okay, we as marketers are saying this circle that I'm in, this is the brand positioning. This is what people care about. And we may have done research or we may be looking out at trends in the marketplace and say, this is how we're going to position ourselves. And then salespeople are out saying, okay, what can I sell? Like I need to sell something. And I personally think that the best brand positioning is where there's that overlap, where there's relevance, right? Because honestly, in marketing, we're throwing stuff up against the wall. We're testing and learning all the time. And in some ways, maybe we are in the ivory tower with our research and doing tests and that kind of thing. But the real test is whenever there's a salesperson sitting across the table from a client and they're listening for, okay, what is the problem that they need to have solved? Maybe research has told us that these are the features and benefits that the customers want. But sometimes, honestly, the customers might not even know exactly what they want. They know generally the problem that they want to solve, or they may have somewhat of an undefined problem. And all they know is that I've got this problem. I need to fix it. I'm not even sure what I need in order to fix it.
And the problem with an untrained salesperson, by the way, is already I can feel a salesperson going, oh boy, do I have a solution for you? And of course, the client doesn't fully understand the problem. How in the world would we fully understand the problem? Even when the client thinks they understand the problem, we're like doctors dispensing medicine. So you've come in and you've diagnosed that you have a torn rotator cuff. Then I'll schedule you for surgery. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute, I got a better idea. Let me take a look at it.
Yeah.
Let me ask you questions you've never asked yourself. Let me not only understand the problem, but go deeper into that problem. That's how we should get paid. It's funny, a lot of times when I work with salespeople, I'll have them list key characteristics around salespeople that they really respect. And if we're playing Family Feud, I'm telling you the number one answer is always product knowledge. And my answer is this, as I almost get escorted out to the parking lot because it upsets people, is I'm not telling you product knowledge shouldn't be on the list. It's going to make the list. But it is clearly the most overrated characteristic of selling. There's a lot of smart people out there. Doesn't mean they can sell. We'll get to the product knowledge. The number one piece would be not just asking questions and listening, which is wonderful, but what you're doing right now, which is not just asking a question and listening, but really taking in the information and asking another question about what we just talked about and going deeper into it. That's what makes not only a good conversation that we're having, but a good sales call. And that's why the good ones get compensated, because they can do that. That's how you earn trust.
Yeah. I'm thinking back to whenever I was that print production manager and buying millions of dollars worth of printing. A lot of times we did have special things. I'm like, I'm not exactly sure how to get this done. I really needed to rely on the expertise of the salespeople to say, okay, I need to talk to somebody in your production department to understand like what's the best, most economical way for us to do this. I didn't have that knowledge. And it was definitely in their best interest to advise me, because it was not transactional. It was a long-term relationship. We had lots of business flowing to the top printers that we worked with. I was talking with somebody the other day who has his own video production company. And we were on this conversation about how you have to start with strategy, right? Like that so many people see something that's tactical and they're like, oh, I want that. He was talking about understanding what it is that they're trying to do. And he advised this one client, you don't need a video. And he talked myself out of business. I don't want them coming back a few months later and saying, hey, it didn't work. But if that's not the right solution, that's the best way to ruin a relationship.
Ruin a relationship and poison the well while you're at it, because not only are you going to ruin the relationship, but I always remember the numbers I was shown, which said a satisfied customer will tell 1 to 3 people about their tremendous experience. And a dissatisfied customer will tell anywhere between 11 and 18 people about their experience.
Yeah,
so
right.
We not only most likely will lose that client in the future, but we'll lose a bunch of others that they're going to have conversations with. And you know what? Even that shouldn't be our reason. Our reason should be because it's wrong. We can't operate that way. I wish more people were aware of that. Sometimes, unfortunately, so much pressure is put on a salesperson to meet that goal. Let's say there's one day left in the quarter and you're one sale away from a $20,000, $30,000 bump bonus. And there's Terry in front of me who kind of needs what I have here. I'm just telling you, I have a very soft spot in my heart, having been in the trenches, to know that this sounds logical, the conversation we're having, but the real world, that line is difficult. It shouldn't be, but it is.
Oh, I can totally understand that. I've been close enough that I see the pressure that people are under, both whenever they were selling to me. I knew what worked and what didn't work when somebody came in and was, I could hear the desperation. Like I knew that they probably were several sales under their quota for the quarter. And I'm kind of like, I'm only going to buy from you if I need something.
Exactly. It can't be your problem. I was maybe 31 years old and I went to a program that Xerox put on. We were working with our agents, and these are authorized dealers of just Xerox copiers and memory writers and some facts. But we went through a 3-day simulation. This is back in 1984, whatever it was. Okay. We go through a 3-day simulation of running our own dealership. And intentionally, on day 2, they would come in and we're trying to get our floppy disk data.
Yeah.
And they came in at one point, strategically said to a bunch of salespeople, hey, listen, if you can move just a few more boxes this quarter, I actually will win a cruise. And to a person, we looked and said, are you out of your mind? We're trying to survive as a business here. And you know what? Years later, I'm looking at you right now and telling you, I never forgot that experience. I never forgot it. What a gutsy, courageous training program that Xerox put together to say, listen, we can lecture you and tell you you're going to put these people out of business if you sell too much to them. we're going to make you dealers for 3 days. And maybe that will help. I think, and I put on a lot of training programs, I think it was the greatest training program I ever attended.
The thing that strikes me is that they put you in a position where you had empathy for them, that you could truly be empathetic with their situation.
Yep. We're competitive, and there were about 4 or 5 teams. So whatever we put on that old floppy was put into a mainframe of some sort, and it ran back what the simulation said we would have sold or not sold. And when you run a dealership and you have product and you're not selling it, you're paying to keep it on the shelf. So we could put a company out of business by overselling them. Now, that looks interesting on paper, but when you're experiencing it as competitive people, and many salespeople, not all, but many of us are pretty competitive. As I said, I never forgot it. There's an old saying, what we hear, we forget, what we see, we remember, what we do, we learn. And I got to tell you, we did that one and I never forgot it.
Yeah, that's so cool. So I was going to ask you, and you've given us a little bit of a taste. You said that Xerox taught you how to sell. What else did they do besides running that simulation program?
Yeah, we went through standardized training, which was 2 weeks, 6 students to 1 instructor. We were on videotape every day. 2 weeks out learning our product. We don't need a trainer to teach you product. You can almost learn that in a closet. And then 2 weeks back in. But here's the cool part, Terry. Again, I'm talking 80s, 90s, early 2000s, when Xerox really was known for its training. Would you believe that those first 2 weeks of training, here comes another courageous move by a company. The first 2 weeks of training that we went through, we never once talked about a copier or any Xerox product. We sold answering machines and airplanes. And what they were teaching us to do was block and tackle. That product's going to get in our way right now. We're going to block and tackle. We're going to learn the sales process and isolate it. So no matter what we put in front of you, you will be able to put it into this process. So that's how you get away with 2 weeks in, learning the process. 2 weeks out, okay, learn your copiers. Okay, back in. Now let's take product and process and put it together. And believe it or not, in my own humble way, although it's always a challenge when my customers first hear this, when I can get away with it, when I sell, a lot of times it won't be a day, but if I have a 2-day program, I run at least 2 role plays without the customer's product, with something else, so that I can just isolate the process, because they end up arguing about, now that's the wrong product. You want this product. If I spend 16 hours teaching someone to sell, and this is a fact, I'll spend about 15 minutes on the product. I don't need the product. A good sales trainer teaches you everything up to actually the product and then what to do afterwards. But why would I come to town and tell somebody who's been selling a product for 15 years how to sell, what the product is? They know that. They just don't know how to get somebody to want it and then what to do after they want it. That's where training comes in.
That's so interesting. What came to mind when you were talking about that is the Karate Kid, the wax on, wax off. Remember that?
Yeah. It becomes
muscle memory. And then you're in the actual situation and you're using those moves that you learned in isolation. Not being self-conscious about, are we telling them all the cool things about the product? Also did a lot of buying as a marketing director. I had advertising dollars and buying software platforms and all kinds of stuff. And I remember one time it was an ad sales guy, and I thought that I only had an appointment with the salesman. But every once in a while, this would happen where the sales manager would show up with the salesperson. And I'd go and meet them in the lobby, and there'd be 2 people instead of 1. But I remember they came into my office, and this situation, the salesperson and sales manager came in, and the guy came in with a notebook that was 3 inches thick. And he sat down and flipped open the notebook to start taking me page by page through this binder. And I'm sitting there looking, and I was like, I don't want to look at that. I told him, I'm not going to sit here and have you go through this thing step by step. I was a marketing person. I'm not even a sales professional, but I was like, I know that you should be asking me what my problems are and what I need to have solved. I thought that was just really strange that they would think they'd come in and hold me captive for an hour to take me step by step through a huge binder.
How long ago was this?
Not that long ago. And maybe it was 10 years ago.
Yeah. I found the financial rep that I work with, I was actually looking for somebody that was very analytical because I wanted somebody who was the opposite of me. I didn't need to be sitting across from me. Yeah. No schmoozing. I want you boring. But this guy did the same thing. I still tease him to this day because a big binder came out, but I knew I was in trouble when I noticed that every page was laminated. Now you know you're in big trouble. And we were looking at Efficient Frontiers, and I said, you're talking to the wrong guy. Listen, and it's actually a really good sales message that we can get across right now. We read personalities, and if I'm dealing with an analytical person, then I'll bring my version of a laminated notebook. I'm not dissing all laminated notebooks. I'm saying read the person that's in front of you. And it appears that neither Terry nor Rob really need every page of the booklet. That doesn't mean get rid of it. That means adapt to who's sitting in front of you and react and keep moving forward.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what you said earlier, but without making the connection with somebody and making them feel like you understand them, you're never going to sell them. Like, I would not buy from people that I don't trust. And I wouldn't trust somebody unless I thought that they understood my problem on a certain level. And just that approach with the notebook, I was like, okay, you're definitely reading the room wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know that you do some other things, that you're an author of a lot of books. You've been very prolific. Tell me about what your process is as an author.
That's a question I don't get a lot, but I love the question. I mentor authors. So one of my first words of wisdom is a lot of times you don't find a book, it finds you, because you're really going to be wed to that book and that material. And so you don't want to just go, gee, that looks interesting, I think I'll write about it. No, you're going to almost marry that material. Obviously, I have a love for selling and I have a love for presenting. So guess what my first two books were? One was on presenting, one was on selling. What was interesting was, it's not that I don't, you know, I have a beer can collection too. I'm an interesting guy, but what else was I going to write about? And one of my publishers, Simon & Schuster, was always after me because they made a lot of money on my book. And they said, when's the next sales book? And I kept saying, I haven't changed my mind. I don't really know what to tell you. The seminar book, at least, technology was changing. I was moving, there's four editions of that one. I was moving from overhead projector to 35 millimeter slides to PowerPoint to Keynote. But to virtual. But so for me, the journey has been to try and keep evolving. For instance, conversation we're having right now about selling. I wonder how many people will listen to this and say, it's an interesting conversation, but I happen to not be a salesperson. And then, of course, we always hear, please, everyone's a salesperson. If that's true, where's the book on that? And so a book that found me was How to Change Minds, The Art of Influence Without Manipulation was, well, what if we don't talk to the briefcase carrying salesperson, and we talk to a parent, we talk to a manager or a nurse or a doctor or somebody who needs to take their idea and put it in somebody else's head, and make them feel like they thought of it. What about that one? I really thought even for salespeople that fail, I think they fail because they don't believe in asking the tougher questions. They feel they might be mean by doing that. A lot of selling requires there's trust base, but a lot of it requires making people uncomfortable. If you don't believe in that, you're going to struggle as a salesperson. So where's the book on that? And so I really wanted to demystify the difference between manipulation and influence, almost a wound. Let's clean that wound out and earn the right to talk about a process that might be involved. But why are we jumping the gun? And here's another process for you. When 3/4 of the world says, that's not for me because I don't want to manipulate people. Terry, you and I both know, neither do I. But if that's the perception, we need to write to it and talk to it. Finish the question off you asked. The process for me is, A, have passion behind what you're going to write. You've got to really care. You got to go to bed and wake up thinking about it. And then B, for me, it's just putting one foot in front of the other or one word in front of the other. But when I mentor people, I tell them, listen, I can help you. I'm going to give you a shovel. I'm going to show you how to hold it. I'm going to show you where to dig. But then you just start digging and there's no mystery to it. Really, as my dad used to say, yeah, guy, he puts his pants on one leg at a time. Classic Marine, Lee Jolisu, I miss dearly. But in fact, most of us authors, we're really the same. We just are a little bit more disciplined and stubborn of, yeah, it's going to take me a lot of hours and I'm going to dig a big, deep hole. But it's sure is nice, Terry, when you care about what it is you're digging into. And so that's why people are after me right now. My last book came out in 2018, and I constantly hear, where's the new book? And if I'm trying to manufacture a passion right now, I'm closing in on something, but I'll tell you when something bites me in the ear and says, here it is. And I'll know when it's there.
Yeah. There's so many things that you said that got me thinking. First of all, as a coach, of course, I can definitely relate to, here's your shovel. This is how you do it. But you got to get digging, right? Like I can't dig it for you. You got to do that on your own. And the other thing that you talked about was that line between influence and manipulation. One of the things that I see a lot, and certainly I saw this whenever I was a leader, and I think a lot of people really shy away from what I would call office politics, because they've observed a lot of people that get ahead by manipulating through being good at the office politics. And maybe they're not so solid. Maybe they're a little bit of an empty suit. They get ahead by ingratiating themselves or manipulating or taking credit for other people's work. For a lot of people, they'll look at that situation and say, I don't want to have anything to do with office politics. But yet, a lot of people will come to me and say, I really want to get ahead and I've been working really hard and nothing's happening. And that really is what you're talking about in terms of selling is something that we all have to do, because selling is about influencing others to take action. And it doesn't have to be an action that doesn't serve them. And in fact, it's always better if it's mutually beneficial. And I'll leave that there for your comments about this whole idea of office politics being about influencing for good.
Let me jump on that. That's a really good point we're on right now. And in this last book that I wrote, which is, again, it's my trilogy in a sense. All right. First, I wrote customer-centered selling, that this is how we sell. And then I wrote, this is why we sell. And that was how to change minds. But then I noticed, and I help a lot of people who are in career transition, who are working with words a lot, resumes and elevator pitches. And I thought, you know what? Nobody's really talking to not just the words, but the tone. So I could write you a great elevator pitch. Doesn't mean it's going to be a great elevator pitch for you. Where is the care and attention to detail of those, of what we say? But in that particular book, and I had to twist the arm of the publisher, it's in three sections, getting us to believe in ourselves, getting others to believe in us. And then the third section is office politics. And how did that creep into a book about words? Because I can help somebody become believable, but can you sustain it? So when you bring up office politics, I could go back in time, Rob of the future, visiting young Rob, and who was that guy? He was like, I will never be involved in office politics. I'm not that guy. Watch Survivor on CBS occasionally. You'll see that show has nothing to do with eating rice and surviving the wilderness. It is a social experiment. And those that do not participate, you just put a bullseye right on your back. Learn the names of each other. Learn their stories. Don't fly too high. You don't have to be the big shot, but you can't be the one with your arms folded saying, I don't want to be involved in any of that, because that is perceived as aggressive by other individuals. So by staying out of politics, you just put a bullseye right on your back. So I don't coach people in that way, but I would hope part of your message would be, listen, like anything else, there's right and wrong, but let's not just throw a curtain over politics and say it's not important. Let's just not do it the wrong way. I have no intention of sucking up to the boss. I do have an intention of not putting the wrong feelings and message out there to my teammates. That's important to me, and it should be to them as well.
Actually, I don't like the idea of sucking up to the boss either. A lot of times, the reason why people avoid it is because they don't want other people to think that if they succeed, that they did it by kissing somebody's rear end. But I think that you can actually make yourself very useful to leaders. And I actually was just talking with somebody about the fact that quite often they don't know everything, right? People sometimes will make assumptions that they're the boss, they know everything. But if somebody is listening for a need that the boss may have and they can help them with that, naturally they're going to be somewhat ingratiated to that person, but like from a place where they're actually providing value. and just being in a balanced place with it, looking for needs that people have and trying to help them. But also, if you need something, going and having the relationship to be able to ask someone, hey, I've got a need, or what kind of information do you have for me? Have you seen this happen? Or I could use a favor. But if you've been making deposits in that favor bank, you can go get them out. But like you said, if you're off in your corner cubicle, head down, you never talk to anybody, and you just think that you're going to get ahead by doing stellar work and never cooperating or collaborating with others, it's probably not going to happen.
No, I actually saw this play out on a regular basis, because when I was a trainer for Xerox, our classes were 2 weeks long and six students. So they get to know each other. And in my seminar book, I actually broke down the types of personalities, and one of them I call is the loner. I realized that's a more dangerous position than you think, not just for the individual, but for the trainer and the room, because it's an interesting psychological experiment. When the group comes together and begins to bond, and one person, a nice person, a good-hearted person, says, I'm not going to have dinner with you all tonight, the group begins to get aggressive towards that individual. It's almost a slap in their face.
Yeah.
So the early Rob Jollis as a trainer went, well, they'll work it out. The seasoned Rob Jollis as a Xerox trainer used to give assignments when I saw that happen, going, okay, tonight you're going to be working on five review questions. I want you to get together as a group. Oh, let's put up their hand and go, is that optional? No, as a group, you get together. You can go to dinner. I don't care where you do it. But I'm actually forcing the individual into that social situation, which, by the way, they can master. It's not as comfortable for them. But sometimes we do things that are uncomfortable. What I learned as a trainer was the nicest thing I could do for that individual was to invent an exercise, not during the program, but off hours, where they would get together. And that smoothed things over. And coincidentally, I used to have very tight groups of six people for 2 weeks that came through it loving each other.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it can be done.
I'm curious, was that typically because somebody was more introverted, that they needed a little help breaking the ice and letting their guard down?
The easy answer would be certainly some of the introverts, for sure. But Barrett Kohler is my current publisher. And when I go to a retreat once a year, and there's a sea of authors that are writing about introverts, and I'm the oddball because I'm actually not the introvert in that group. I'm learning more and more about introverts. Sometimes, as long as there's multiples, they'll band together. So I'm not going to just throw it all on the introverts. It's people that are actually a little socially clumsy. And that doesn't necessarily define an introvert. And quite frankly, if I were a therapist, I would say probably could just use a couple hours on that one. But I'm not. I'm a trainer. So I'm thinking I'm going to help you survive this scenario. But that's why I termed them loners. I think this was their pattern. They're more comfortable that way. Certainly an introvert is more likely to move in that direction. Quite frankly, some of them, like I said, I never knew autism in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I'm someone who is very low on the scale of autism. I think there's just some social discomfort that some people have. And back then, we didn't really know what it was.
Sure.
I just knew as a trainer, I can work this through. But it was a manual maneuver. I thought it'll settle itself out. What it did was it drew a bigger spike. I would hear people say, yeah, we had a great time last night. At least most of us got together, and there would be a giggle, and it would feel just terrible. And of course, the other individual, it's not like they didn't feel that. But that's when I realized, what am I doing here waiting for this to magically repair itself? I could spot it in a two-week program in the icebreaker in the first 15 minutes. I could tell you if we have one or two and what we're going to do about it. Doesn't take me long.
I think that's so interesting, because there was probably a repeating pattern there with that person, that they had been rejected in the past. And so they were like, I'm just going to avoid this by not even getting involved. But the irony of it is that because they were avoiding it, they were actually getting rejected. But you were forcing it with this. I have confidence that if you're going to almost be the external force, that you have to be part of this group, that they were like, okay, I can overcome that. The interesting thing is that these were salespeople, but I know there's different types, right? So that's very interesting. So I know that you've also got another sideline that you do as an auctioneer. And that's a way of influencing and selling. How did that happen?
Oh my goodness. First of all, how did it happen? I was at my temple and they wanted to have an auction, and somehow they heard I was a professional speaker and they said, why don't you just do it? And I said, all right. I didn't know what I was doing. And I really butchered it up because I kept thinking it was a seminar. People were drinking and talking, and you don't drink and talk in a seminar, by the way. So I really spent the hour going, please, folks, please, I'm over here. Please listen to the chair. In Virginia, it's 80 hours required instruction certified to be able to sit through the exam. But I decided I'm going to figure this thing out. So I got licensed about 11 years ago. By the way, that temple made about $4,000 on that first auction. They did a total of 9 with me. They made a little over $500,000 with those 9 auctions. So it sure beats a car wash.
Yeah. But
I'll tell you what I love about it. Most professional speakers, most trainers are almost frustrated actors. And an element within all of us of wanting to get up and perform. Well, as a trainer, or even as a guy delivering keynotes, listen, I'm going to entertain, I'll inspire, I'll motivate, but I'm there to teach you something. If I don't do that, I failed that audience. But the beauty of an auction is, it is like a tethered Rob Jollis. I don't have to teach you anything. Occasionally I'll stray, but almost all my auctions are charity, which in my head, I'm working for Hope for a Healthier Humanity. And if I have to grab you by your ankles and shake you upside down, I'm going to get every penny out of you. And learning the auction chant was never the hard part. Getting up and holding an audience and inspiring. We professional speakers, we're natural at that. It is a lot of fun for me. I enjoy it. I do a lot of charities. And it's a tremendous source of pride. Whatever skills I was given as a trainer, I get to use for really a good thing. It's really wonderful.
I took this assessment years ago. It's one of these ones that like tells you about yourself and your motivations and stuff. And two things I remember about it. One was that Terry has no desire to operate large machinery. And I was like, yeah, that's absolutely right. I do not. But Terry has a driving need to influence. And as you're talking, that's one thing I think you and I have in common. My guess is that your need to influence might be even a little bit further to the right than mine is, because you're doing it in so many different aspects of what you do for a living.
It's true. It is funny. My dad was a salesman. And when I was in Boy Scouts, we sold light bulbs. We sold first aid kits for the back of cars. We actually sold donuts on weekends. And I was in a troop that had 120 boys, but I was already into, I loved competing. As an athlete, I loved competing. Sales to me was, gee, I get to compete in a different way. I loved the competitive element of just outsmarting and outworking the 11-year-old to my right and left of me. It just started early. I sold toothbrushes for the track team I was on in high school. I knew when I was at Maryland, it was probably going to be sales for me. I just didn't know which element of sales. And back then, actually, I graduated in 1979. So back in 1979, if you wanted to make the most money selling, you sold insurance.
Yeah, you can still make a great living in financial services planning. Sales.
Yeah,
definitely. Definitely. Be close to the money. So Rob, before we close out, any last words of wisdom?
You got me on a few topics here. So between auctioneering, writing books, and selling, how about we tie them all together and say, maybe just whatever it is, make it your passion. I work with people in career transition for 10 years. That's one of my things that I do as a volunteer. Listen, in this world, we're on a journey. We're on a path. It isn't a straight line. Sometimes we just got to do what we got to do. But pursue your dreams. I mean, and just remember that you don't go from step one to dream. Sometimes you angle and you go here and there. But when I sold insurance, I thought, what am I doing here? I'm wasting these couple of years. And I promise you that everything, for some weird reason, everything that's on that journey and on that path, they all connect. I wouldn't have been hired by Xerox if I didn't have my insurance background, because they were looking for somebody at Xerox to work with Crum and Forster, who was owned by Xerox. It all ties together in some weird way. Never discount what you're doing, but never lose sight of what you're aiming for, because you'll get there. You just have to keep plodding along.
That is sage advice. Thank you so much, Rob. So tell me, where can people find you?
Oh, it's pretty easy, actually. If you just go to my website, jolles.com, you can find me there. I write something called a blarticle. It's not a blog. It's not an article. It's a blarticle. But I've written that for 12 years now. Every other Friday, a blarticle comes out. And then pocket-sized pep talks. But you'll learn all that if you get to the website at jollis.com. That's the best, easiest place to find me.
Okay. And I will put links on the show notes to your website, to the pocket-sized pep talks and the books and everything.
I'll even give you a link to the auctioneer, Jollis Auctioneer Services, at your service, yeah. Particularly if you're a charity. And I love hearing them. Whenever I work with charity, they'll say, we made $8,000 last year. And I'll tell them, good, we're going to make $14,000 this year. You got a competitive Rob. I like to know what the number that I'm going to beat is.
A professional auctioneer makes a huge difference. I was on a nonprofit board, and it's worth every penny to get somebody who knows what they're doing to come in and get people to reach for their wallets and checkbooks.
Yep.
Rob, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Love the conversation. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Marketing Mambo. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, like, and share. I'd love to hear from you. Check out the show notes for my social media and contact information. Until next time, adios.